Hello, my name is Paul Collins.
You ever feel like you're one of the most popular rock musicians whose anonymity has even made you more popular?
You know, I'm totally in favor of that description. I'm just happy to still be alive and playing music.
Okay, here we are at South by Southwest, and, you know, at least the people on this side of the fence are not, you know, 3 years old, but rock and roll provides, and in the end, you know, you've done a lot of stuff.
Well, I'll tell you, to tell you the truth, the 90s, I pretty much dropped off the radio screen, and it was not a good decade for me. And when I came out of the 90s, I was really at ground zero. My career was pretty much in a shambles, and I hadn't had a record out in 12 years, which, according to Elvis Presley, pop culture changes every 6 months, so you can do the math. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether it was just I had had a good run, and it was time to hang up the guitar and just say, you know, lots of great memories. But the problem with that is, I didn't know what else I could do. I mean, you know, if you played rock and roll for 30 years, you're pretty much unfit for anything. And I was unfit even for rock and roll. So it was a pretty bad situation. And but I think, you know, as history has proven with a lot of different people in a lot of different walks of life, I was at that point was sink or swim. And I decided I wanted to swim. And that's when I recorded my last album, Flying High, which I did in my living room on a shoestring budget. But I just told myself that, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I should have the craft and I should have the intuition to do something really good that I felt was really, you know, something worth doing. And knock on wood, I made an album that, A, I'm very proud of, and I think it's an outstanding piece of work, and it was done with all the right motives. I think the big thing for me is when you do this music for a long time, you get caught up in the industry and what the industry wants and doing it for the industry, and that's a huge mistake. And I decided on this record, I'm going to do this because I love music and I love playing music, and that's got to be the right place to be. And I think I was right. The reception of the record, we did the record, it's been out for a little while. It came out in Spain first, then it came out in France to absolutely incredible reception, and now it's come out here in America. And we're here at South by Southwest. This is my first South by Southwest appearance, and to promote the release in America.
You've stolen half my questions. No, I'm kidding. I always do that. You are trained at Juilliard composition, right? And you went into rock and roll. Do you think the money was better?
Well, the Juilliard thing is kind of funny. My mother, one day I was sitting at the breakfast table in Leonia, New Jersey, having breakfast. I was 17, and she comes in. She says, I'm taking you to Juilliard. You're gonna do this. Today's the last day of whatever, you know,
auditions,
right? And I said, Mom, come on, I don't even know how to write music. These people are going to look at me like I'm nuts. But I had done a project with my mother. My mother's an artist, and she's an abstract artist, and we had done a piece called The Elements, and it was modern music, which I had composed on 4-track tapes, and her work. So I took that tape, and I went in, and I filled out the application as a composer. And they sent me to the head of the composition department. I played in my tape, and he said, I want you as a student. And it was like, what? You know, because Juilliard's a school that you do the audition and you wait a year to find out if you got in. I was accepted the very same day. Now, of course, 1 year at Juilliard was enough for everybody, including the school, to know that this was not the right place for Paul Collins. So I did a year there, and then I went out to California in search of a rock band, and I found one, The Nerves.
In New York, once you decided, but before you went to California, you spent a lot of time at the Fillmore East, which was very different back then, as we all know, as was the industry.
Well, you know, I was very lucky to have seen a lot of great shows there. I saw the original Santana. I saw Hot Tuna there. I saw Mountain there. I saw, oh, God knows, just tons of bands. And I was very young at the time, and it was great. You could go there, and you would just get stoned by sitting in your seat. I mean, stuff would be flying by. You'd say, no, 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 it didn't matter. You didn't have to take anything. And my fondest memory of the Fillmore, besides hearing fabulous music, great light shows, the whole thing, is going down to the men's room to take a leak and walking in alone, and all of a sudden, like, 8 Hell's Angel guys walk in, and I'm, like, petrified. And then Bill Graham walks in. So there's me, 8 Hell's Angels guys, and Bill Graham. And Bill Graham is not a very tall man.
He's an imposing presence.
Yeah. So I'm like holding my private, looking over at Bill Graham, who's looking up at these like 6-foot tall Hell's Angels guys, and he's screaming at them, "I told you guys, if you ever come in here," and they're going, Bill, we're sorry, Bill, promise, we will never do it again. And I sneak out of the bathroom before anybody sees me and immortalizes me. But yeah, it was an incredible place. It was very sad to see it eventually turn into a disco and then be torn down to what it is today, which is condominiums. I used to go to sleep every single night with my little transistor radio glued to my head and listening to those guys. And the strongest memory is just the reverb on the voices. These guys...
They had a Fisher Spring reverb on everything, yes.
They sounded like gods. They really sounded like gods. And then was it Alice and the Nightbird and Scott Muni and the whole FM thing. And then you really got the feel of the difference between like WABC, even though the music was incredible. But that was just a very great time, and you got everything. That was my part of the foundation of my musical education, because it was British Invasion, it was the California sound, it was the Detroit sound, it was Stax, it was Johnny Cash, it was everything. So you could really get the full palette, not just American music, just the whole rock and roll thing, and even stuff like, you know, Frankie Valli, Lou Christie, all that. So you had the whole nine yards, and that's really, for me, I think, when I just knew, I didn't know I was going to do it, but I said, man, if I could do this, if I could even get close to doing this, it's yeah.
A short stint in England, and then what drove you out? We're going in chronological order here. And then what drove you out west?
Well, what drove me out west, literally, is I was, I guess, around almost 18, and I was living in New York City, and an old high school girlfriend, called me up and said, "I'm going to California. You want to go?" And I said, "Yeah." And so we drove across country together. We got busted in Sault Ste. Marie for having, according to the guy, the Border Patrol guy, he found a marijuana seed in her carburetor. And so we finally made it. We split up in Lake Tahoe, and I hitchhiked from Lake Tahoe into Berkeley, into San Francisco. And I got to San Francisco. I had $80 in my pocket. And all I knew is that I wanted to find a band. And on my third day there, I went to Don Weir's Music City, whose slogan is, "When you're ready." They'll never forget that. And I went up to the bulletin board, and there was a 3x5 index card saying, at that time I was playing drums, wanted drummer for all original rock band, a la the Beatles and the Stones.
Is that Jack Lee?
Call Jack. And I said, "That's the number." And that's the only card I took, and I called him. And it was great, because I went right out of the store, across the street, Columbus Street, there was a payphone. I called him up. He said, "Come on over now," you know, and it was just perfect, because, you know, I didn't want to hear, "Oh yeah, let's get together next week," or whatever. It was like, now. So I got on the trolley. I went up to Pine and Gough, and I met Jack, and he played me "Hanging on the Telephone." And before the song was over, I said,
he had it at that point.
He had a demo of it, which was a fabulous demo, which I don't know if it's ever, it would be great to get that on the internet or on something, because it was an incredible version that he did with Pat Stengel, his childhood buddy who had come down with him from Jack was from Alaska. And when I heard that, I said, "Yeah, man, that's it." And then I said, "Well, where's the rest of the band?" And he said, "Oh, don't worry about that."
So where did Peter come into the picture?
Well, that was the thing. I said, "Where's the rest of the band?" He said, "Don't worry about that. There's this guy we got to get." And
Peter,
I said,
"What?"
Jack and Peter had a bit of a history before I came onto the scene, and they had tried unsuccessfully to do some projects together, and it never worked out. But Jack knew that Peter was the guy. So we went to go see Peter at the Wharf. He was playing with his buddy Danny, and he was doing... You have to realize, at that time, I'm talking 1974, saying the Beatles or Chuck Berry, and people went, "Eh, it was like a dirty word, and I was going, whoa. Right. So nobody was singing songs like that with harmonies and all that stuff. So we went and saw Peter and Danny at the Wharf, and they were playing Everly Brothers and stuff, and Peter is an absolutely incredible singer. And even, you know, just the first time I heard him, I said, "Man, this guy is the shit." And but he was like, you know, "I'm gonna do my own thing," and because Jack was saying, "Look, Jack was saying, you know, you got to be cool with Peter. You can't just come up. And so I just came up and said, you want to start a band with us, man? You know, I was.
To this day, you've got to be cool with Peter.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't be, and I still am not, you know. But
still not either,
so he was like, you know, I'm thinking of doing my own thing. But eventually he came around, and at that point he was playing guitar. And in the Nerves, we were really a trio, and we needed bass. So Peter switched from guitar to bass. I remember we spent hours and hours at Jack's rooming house going over the songs, not with the gear, just I was playing on a phone book, and Peter was like doing all the parts on bass. And but man, when I say the three of us, because it was the three of us, but when Jack and Peter got together, it was like I just every day I had goosebumps just listening to those guys sing and play together. And of course, I hadn't written a song then, and I was green with envy. And you know, Jack was ahead of Peter, but they both had great songs, and I was like, man, I gotta write a song. And it took me 2 years, literally every day, working on trying to write a song. And the first song I wrote was Working Too Hard. And the thing is, I had to write a song that passed Jack's approval. I'd say, what do you think about this? He said, you know, come on, work on a little bit more, man. Go back, you know. And finally, when I did Working Too Hard, he said, yeah, Working Too Hard and You Won't Be Happy. And he said, yeah, those are good songs. And I went, wow, I made it into the club, you know, because they really formed a big part of my schooling, because I looked up to them in every way, singing, the harmonies, the playing. I mean, I was very fortunate to get involved with musicians of that caliber, especially Jack. Jack had a bar of excellence that he wanted to achieve. And we used to go every day at Vesuvio's. You'd see him sitting there with reams of paper going over lyrics. So I learned like the process of that you really have to work on this stuff.
So from parking cars at the Whiskey to, you know, the Bill Graham connection, which suddenly came, next thing you know, you became, you know, the second act he managed after Eddie Money. And it's interesting because, you know, people love, it was an interesting time in rock and roll, and people love to make fun of Mr. Money, but his last name became highly appropriate, and he actually, you know, kicked out some pretty amazing music. But what was it like to have Bill Graham's people embrace you?
Well, it was, first of all, my connection with Eddie Money is, I mean, first of all, he was, I mean, a great guy, an unusual connection for the type of music I make and the type of music he made. But I met him when we were in the Nerves, because in those days, the Pink section was the Bible on Sunday. You get the Pink section because it told you all the bands that were playing and all the clubs, and you just look at it, these assholes are playing and these idiots are playing. How come we can't get a gig? Why can't? And so I used to see his name all the time. So I said, look, I'm going to call this guy up and see what's up. So I called him up. He was living in Oakland. I said, look, I'm Paul Collins. We got this, I got the band The Nerves. We made our own 45. And he was totally cool. He said, well, come on over to the house and play it for me. Went over to his house and played it for him, and he was like, wow, that's really good. And he took me under his wing. We did shows with him.
Who would have ever thought, you know, because that's a great backstory. Eddie Money, right?
Yeah. No, and he was, first of all, if you had seen Eddie Money at playing at the Longhorn in 1974 with Jimmy Lyons, Eddie was playing sax, and he had a bass player and a drummer. It was like a rockin' show, and he was great. I learned a lot from Eddie about, Eddie knew how to work a crowd. Eddie knew the stage. You know, he was a real performer. And so he took me under, because I was in New York, and I remember him saying, he said, you know, don't worry, kid, I'm going to take care of you. You got to watch yourself out here. The crazy motherfuckers out here in California. Us New Yorkers got to stick together. And but then the Nerves moved down to L.A., and I lost contact with him. And then when I heard he'd got signed, I said, well, that's one guy I'm never going to see again. Because, you know, you got to understand, in those days, you understand. All right. I'm talking to the people out there in radio land. There was no underground independent scene. And the major labels, you were talking like, you know, trying to get an appointment with the President of the United States. It was just off limits.
Clive Davis had assistance upon assistance upon assistance.
Yeah, I mean, and you could not approach a record company. You could not even approach a manager or a lawyer. I mean, just, it was a lockout. So when he got signed, I figured, well, that's it. But one day when the Beat was rehearsing, I went around the corner, and we were rehearsing at The Mask, which was the first, Brendan Mullins, the first official punk club in L.A., went around the corner on Hollywood Boulevard to buy some beers and some smokes, and lo and behold, there's Eddie doing an in-store at Peaches. Remember Peaches?
Oh, yeah.
And I see him, and I go, oh, wow, Eddie Money. So I kind of stick my head in, I stand in the back, and I say, Eddie, remember me? And he goes, boy, how are you? Hang around, man. Let's get together after I'm done with this. So after I waited, we went over to my house, and we wrote Let Me Into Your Life. That day I had been working on it. So we wrote Let Me Into Your Life, and he picks up the phone and he calls the president of Columbia Records, Al Teller. And I'm like, you know, Eddie, you know, this is like this. This is too much for me to handle. So he calls up Al and he says, "Al, I'm with my buddy Paul Collins. We want to play you this song we just wrote." So we and it's a Saturday, and Al is like, "Eddie, I'm in the pool with my kids. Come on, man. Can't this wait till Monday?" He says, no, we got to play it for you now. So we play him Let Me Into Your Life over the phone. And he goes, "That's nice, Eddie. That's great. See you later. Talk to you later." But he talked me up for a year solid to everybody and anybody. This great songwriter, Paul Collins. And I remember I'd see him in some fancy hotel, and he'd have all his other friends with like $50,000 demos. And he'd play my cassette that sounded like crap. And eventually, Bruce Botnick, his producer, enrolled. We had made a 12-song demo, me and Steve Huff, and we gave him that, and he really loved it. And then Columbia actually signed us, because Bruce got Al Teller to come down to the Mask. Had you ever been to the Mask?
Yeah.
Well, you know what it's like. I mean, it was smelled of urine for years.
Nice place.
In a little teeny room, on a Saturday, Al Teller had just come from flying his private plane, and we play the 12 songs, and Al's there, and he turns to Bruce and he says, "Okay, sign him," and leaves. And that's how we got our deal. And we were like, "What? We just got signed to Columbia Records." And so then Bill Graham actually came on board afterwards, because Columbia had signed us, and Bill was still like, he wasn't sure if he wanted to take us on. And then we did some big shows up in San Francisco at the Kabuki, was our first show. I think it was opening up for Eddie, and he signed us. And then it was like, I was like, I'd been looking at the Columbia label since I was a kid on Johnny Cash and all those records, and I said, "I can't believe this." And those were heady times.
This record is, as you mentioned, 12 years in the making, which is pretty insane. Obviously, the songs were written over that time. That's a long time to write a record. Even
it better be good, man.
Well, or just, you know, it's but you made it, and that's the point. So it was really, you said, recorded in your living room. Now, it was recorded in July of 2004.
Yes.
In a space of 3 days, and we're sitting here in March of 2007. So
what the hell happened in between?
So that would be rock and roll, right?
Well, actually, we recorded the album. I mean, as anybody out there who does this knows, we recorded the album. Then we went into Mixland, and that took another 6 to 7 months of torture. Then we had it done, and at that point, also what happened is we made the fatal mistake. I did this record on my own because I said, look, I've got to take control of my own life. I can't sit around and make demos to give to companies and wait and just, you know, spin my wheels for another. And we actually fell back into the trap, because once the album was done, and before it was mixed, we started getting into the passing the roughs around, which was a big mistake. And that ate out 3 or 4 months. And I got so frustrated. I said, what am I doing? I made this album myself, and now I'm back into the same goddamn thing of sending tapes out. No, I finished the record, finished the mixes. And at that point, there was a company in Madrid that a gentleman, Pablo Carrero, he said, look, I'm going to start a new label. And it's a man I knew for a long time. And I said, okay, this is where I'm going. They gave me a nice chunk, a big, nice advance. Everything seemed right. And then the record came out in 2005, right? And I'm sitting here with the other gentleman that made this record with me, actually, and the man that really was instrumental in helping me arrange it all and get it together, my guitar player, Mr. Octavio Vink, and the gentleman who played drums on it, Ginés Martínez. And so then it came out in Spain, and I have a very, very big and loyal following in Spain, and I've also always received great press, so we got great press in Spain. Then the company in Spain negotiated a deal with the label in France called MVS Records. Then it was released in France, and the reception was actually, for me, even better, the press in France, because I've done a lot of work in these countries over the years. And I was very happy that they still remembered me. And, you know, you never know. I mean, I was very nervous when this first record came out, because it's like so much time had gone by. I mean, people could say, yeah, so what? But no, I was afforded great press and great reaction from my fans. And we've been playing, and we went to Paris, and we had a great show, and we're going back in June to do some festivals. And now it's come out here with people that I've worked with for many years, Get Hip, Greg and Barbara. And Greg is totally excited, totally behind the record. I feel like the record is like the little train that could, you know? And I recorded it in my living room because Octavio and I definitely had a very firm, clear in our minds that we wanted to make a very unpretentious record that really focused in on the strengths of the songs. If the songs were good, the record was going to work, and we weren't going to try to rely on studio production. And I'm really glad we did, because we made a very beautiful, simple, fragile record that's like the mix and everything, the gentleman who mixed it. It's got air in it, but it's simple and honest.
Your son makes his vocal debut on the record.
Yes, that's another highlight of my life, having a son. My son's name is Noah, and he's a beautiful boy, and it's one of the best things I've ever done, and I've been really blessed to have a healthy, beautiful child. And he sings on the Yaz, and he in Rock and Roll Shoes, and he's also in the party scene, which is in the guitar solo of Helen. And I was very proud.
We've invented a little thing called a musical sandwich. Two or three of your songs as the bread, and then as many songs by other bands as you want to play in between.
On the bottom side, Rock and Roll Girl. Mm-hmm. On the top side of this Dagwood, we're talking about a Dagwood here,
yes. Okay?
Helen, off my latest record.
Yep.
And in between, I would have to have Nadine by Chuck Berry, I Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones, Friday on My Mind by the Easy Beats, Lightning Strikes Twice by Lou Christie, and oh well, we gotta have a Beatles song in there. What's that one? I Nearly Died. No Reply. Okay. I would say I would stick in the Nerves version of Hanging on the Telephone. I would also say that I would put in a Rolling Stones song, She's a Rainbow.